Now, what's significant about this fire, I personally think, and there are some early texts that speak along these lines, that Peter died in this persecution. It's a local persecution. Our Lord does indicate to Peter in Acts 20 and John 21 that he would die as a martyr. There would come a time when he would be taken where others would take him where he did not want to go. And early church tradition has that Peter died as a martyr. In this actual, Tertullian mentions that about 100 years later, in this actual persecution. And what's significant about this persecution is it sets the church at odds with the empire. The empire now becomes the main persecutor of the church. It's hard to believe what I'm about to say, but it's true. From 64 to 312, within the Roman Empire, the church undergoes persecution for 250 years. That's older than the American Republic, United States. What that means for a number of things. First of all, let me just sketch a few aspects of that persecution. Then we'll break, and then when we come back, I want to look at the letter of Pliny the Younger that I passed out. What that means is, first of all, it means to be a Christian meant the distinct possibility of dying as a martyr. That was always something that was born in mind. Baptism then and entry into the Christian community were marks that set you apart from that larger culture. And the possibility of dying as a martyr was ever present. This does not mean, please note what this does not mean, this does not mean that persecution was continuous and empire-wide for 250 years. First of all, when the empire did try to have empire-wide persecution, again, there were limitations to that. Roman society was not totalitarian as we know it today. It's a dictatorship that is not totalitarian. 20th century totalitarianism is a society in which all of the media are completely controlled by the state, and there is day-to-day surveillance of every person. That doesn't exist for the Romans. The Romans don't have that ability. If they'd had it, they would have done it. But they didn't. Nonetheless, it does mean the distinct possibility that every Christian had to reckon with the possibility of martyrdom. Persecution, though, is not empire-wide all through this period, nor is it continuous. There are periods of persecution, some of them more intense. Generally speaking, between 64 and 200, they are local persecutions. This is generally speaking. And then from 200 to 312, they are empire-wide persecutions when they happen. They are not, as I said, please note, this is very important, they are not continuous. The church was not in a continuous state of having its members martyred. But when persecution did happen in this first half of this first period, it was normally local persecutions. What that would normally be is somebody would take accusations, as we will see, to the local governor or a local magistrate. They will say such and such a person is a Christian. Christianity is illegal. And then there will be a trial and martyrdoms. In this period of time, the emperor himself would initiate persecution. This persecution initiated by Nero is not empire-wide. As far as we know, it's restricted to Rome. But from 200 to 312, there are empire-wide persecutions. There is now a distinct attempt by the state to destroy the church. And we'll look at something of the strategy in that regard down the road. It also means that the church's growth is grounded in martyrdom. This makes the church's experience in these early centuries very different from the church in the West today. We know nothing of this. That does not mean the church worldwide knows nothing of this. One of the things that a study like this should awaken us to is the realization of the fact that there is, in many parts of the world today, martyrs. In fact, scholars have said that since the advent of the 20th century, there have been more martyrs in the history of the church than in this early period. And we need to be those who pray for the persecuted church, or understand something of the challenges church in places like China, parts of the remaining communist world, parts of Africa, the Muslim world, are going through. And I think one of the great challenges before the church today in the West is to raise up evangelists for the Muslim world, and to pray that God would raise up men and women to go to take the gospel to Muslims. If we do that, we're asking people to contemplate the possibility of martyrdom. And the early church can help us enormously thinking through. In the West today, we don't have a theology of martyrdom. And we need to think through, well, what does martyrdom mean? What is a martyr saying? We need to recognize that martyrdom, actually, the early church believed this, and I think they were right. Martyrdom is a gift to the church. It's a spiritual gift that God gives to the church. And I would base that on 1 Corinthians 13:3, where Paul talks about various gifts, and speaking in tongues, the gift of knowledge, the gift of faith, the gift of giving. And then if I give my body to be burned, but do not have love. And the early church interpreted that to be that one of the gifts of the Spirit is martyrdom. On a little side note, sometimes I have an interesting time with, you know, Pentecostals who tell you they believe in all the gifts being active today. They'd like all the gifts. And I sometimes say, well, are you actually praying for this one? And it's quite naughty, but anyway. We need to develop that, I think. Who knows the sort of situation our children, our grandchildren might go through? And one of the themes of the early church is they would remember the martyrs as a way of preparing themselves spiritually and mentally for the situation in which public witness would often result sometimes in martyrdom or attack. No. Muslim understanding of martyrdom is quite different. It is something I've just actually picked up a book on that whole area, which I haven't read, on Muslim understanding of martyrdom. There has been a shift in Muslim thinking about martyrdom. I'm actually loath to describe Muslims as martyrs, because the word martyr is a Christian word. Comes from a Greek word, martis, which means witness. In the book of Acts, the word, Jesus uses it in Acts 1:8. You will be my martyres. That's the plural. That just means witness. A martis or martyres is either a person or persons who have specific knowledge that they will produce in a court of law. Normally. That's the idea of it. By the end of the New Testament period, in Acts chapter, in Revelation chapter 2, we read about Antipas, my faithful martyr. And that is in Acts 2:13. Antipas, my faithful martyr, was slain among you. Acts 2:13. And By the end of the New Testament period, the word has become narrowed from a larger term meaning witness to a person who is a witness that gives his life for his witness. And in the early church, you do not have any examples of Christians killing their persecutors and being killed and then claiming to be martyrs. And so the whole Muslim, the Islam has co-opted that word. And I do not think that the man who flew those planes into the Twin Towers in Manhattan are martyrs. They're terrorists. And they gave their lives, obviously, for that act of terrorism, but they're hardly martyrs. And so the Muslim concept is quite different, because invariably the Muslim concept is this person who dies in battle fighting the infidel is a martyr. But that is so different from the Christian concept, so completely different. And let me stop here and take a question, and then we'll break.
Very famous scientist of his day. His uncle's claim to fame was not only a number of books that he wrote, but also the fact that he died in the eruption of Vesuvius at Pompeii. Pliny the Elder had a what we would describe as a villa around the bay, and he was there with Pliny the Younger on the day of the eruption in 79 AD, saw the eruption, and demanded that he be rowed across to view it firsthand, as a scientist would want to do, and was a man who suffered from asthma and actually died on the beach from the air being filled with asphalt and so on. Pliny has two very famous letters. That account of the eruption of Vesuvius is one of them, an eyewitness account because he was across the bay, his uncle dying on the beach. And then this letter. By the year 106, 107, maybe as late as 110, Pliny was a fairly recognized important figure in the city of Rome. A lawyer by training, he had been appointed by the Roman Emperor Trajan to take care of the water system in Rome, getting fresh water in through the aqueducts and getting sewage out. And he had done such a good job that the emperor made him the governor of Pontus and Bithynia. And if you look at the map there, Pontus and Bithynia are on the southern part of the Black Sea, central northern Turkey. They are mentioned, by the way, in Holy Scripture. First Peter mentions them. They're mentioned in the book of Acts. So Pontus and Bithynia. And the two provinces were in something of an economic shambles. Pliny's job, so to speak, was to go there to revitalize the economy. And so what he does initially is he determines to go around the province, city by city, town by town, to kind of get a feel for the lay of the land. And when he comes to one particular town, he encounters accusations being made by some citizens against others who they are claiming are Christians. And his great problem is to know how to deal with those who deny, they admit to being Christians, but then deny they're being Christians now. How should they be punished for having once been Christians, and so on? But in the course of that whole query, he details to the Roman Emperor Trajan what he has actually done, and in doing so, he relates to us an account of one of the earliest pagan account of Christianity. And it's of value for a number of reasons. We'll be looking at it for two areas. One is the issue of worship, and the other is the old area of martyrdom. It is my rule, sire, to refer to you in matters where I am uncertain, for who can better direct my hesitation or instruct my ignorance? I was never present at any trial of Christians. Therefore, I do not know what are the customary penalties or investigations and what limits are observed. I have hesitated a great deal in the question whether there should be any distinction of ages, whether the weak should have the same treatment as the more robust, whether those who recant should be pardoned, whether a man who has ever been a Christian should gain nothing by ceasing to be such, whether the name itself, even if it isn't a crime, should be punished, or only the crimes attaching to that name. Meanwhile, this is the course that I've adopted in the case of those brought before me as Christians. I ask them if they are Christians. If they admit it, I repeat the question a second and a third time, threatening capital punishment. If they persist, I sentence them to death. For I do not doubt that whatever kind of crime it may be to which they have been confessed, their pertinacity and inflexible obstinacy should certainly be punished. There were others who displayed a like madness.
and whom I reserved to be sent to Rome, since they were Roman citizens. Thereupon the usual result followed. The very fact of my dealing with the question led to a wider spread of the charge. A great variety of cases were brought before me. An anonymous pamphlet was issued, containing many names. All who denied that they were had been Christians, I considered should be discharged, because they called upon the gods at my dictation, and did reverence with incense and wine to your image, which I had ordered be brought forward for this purpose, together with the statues of the deities. And especially because they cursed Christ, a thing which it is said genuine Christians cannot be induced to do so. Others named by the informer first said that they were Christians, then denied it, declaring they had been, but were no longer. Some had been recanted 3 years or more before, and one or two as long ago as 20 years. They all worshipped your image and the statues of the gods and cursed Christ. But they declared that the sum of their guilt or error had amounted only to this, that on an appointed day they had been accustomed to meet before daybreak, to recite a hymn antiphonally to Christ as to a god, to bind themselves by an oath, not for the commission of any crime, but to abstain from theft, robbery, adultery, and breach of faith, and not to deny a deposit when it was claimed. After the conclusion of the ceremony, it was accustomed to depart, meet again to take food, but it was ordinary harmless food, and they had ceased this practice after my edicts, in which, in accordance with the orders, I had forbidden secret societies. I thought it the more necessary, therefore, to find out what truth there was in this by applying torture to two maidservants who were called deaconesses. But I found nothing but a depraved and extravagant superstition, and I therefore postponed my examination and had recourse to you for consultation. The matter seemed to me to justify my consulting you, especially on account of the number of those imperiled, for many persons of all ages and classes and of both sexes are being put in peril by accusation, and this will go on. The contagion of this superstition has spread not only in the cities, but in the villages and rural districts as well, yet it seems capable of being checked and set right. There is no shadow of doubt that the temples, which have been almost deserted, are beginning to be frequented once more, that the sacred rites which have long been neglected are being renewed, and that sacrificial victims are for sale everywhere, where still recently a buyer was rarely to be found. From this, it is easy to imagine what a host of men could be set right were they given a chance of recantation. Now that, is the longest account that we have of the Christians from a pagan source in this very early period. It's the earliest and longest account. It is very revealing in many, many respects of Roman attitudes towards Christianity. It tells us also a number of things about the nature of the church. First of all, by the way, the numbers in brackets are the sections. Pliny the Younger left 10 books of letters. This is letter 96, and the sections within it then are like what we might describe as verses. First of all, notice in section 1, Pliny says he has never been present at any trial of Christians. Now, he's a lawyer. He practiced law in Rome. What that means then is that while he knew of trials, he knew of the fact that Christians were placed on trial, they were not frequent enough for him to know how to prosecute the case. Otherwise, he wouldn't be writing the letter. In other words, he has legal difficulties. That's the issue at stake here. Certain legal difficulties, which deal with various questions that he details in section 2. But if he had been party to these trials, if they had been a frequent occurrence, as a lawyer, he would have been aware of them and have details about them, he wouldn't be writing this letter. What it means then is persecution of Christianity was taking place in Rome, but it was not widespread and it was not ongoing so that a lawyer like Pliny would have access to it. The questions in section 2 are a number. For instance, extent of punishment. Should the weak be given the same treatment as the more robust? In other words, should there be some sort of acquittal made based on strength? Normally what this would come down to in Roman circles is, should women be exempt? It's not an account I've given you, but one of the most remarkable accounts of an early martyr is the martyrdom of a woman named Perpetua, who was martyred in the year 202. And at her trial, the Roman governor insists a number of times, "You're a woman. Remember, you're a woman." And I had the full extent of the law that I can throw at you. In other words, there was an attempt to convince her that she couldn't go through what he was about to throw at her because of her gender and the weakness of her gender. In other words, he wouldn't have done that with a man. With a man, normally you've got the three questions. The one question being asked three times, are you a Christian? Are you a Christian? Are you a Christian? But normally women then would get some preferential treatment. Although if they insisted, as Perpetua did, she was a believer, she would also be martyred. The second question is, what kind of basis should he actually be investigating this? Is the name itself to be punished? Why are we punishing these Christians? Is it the name? Is it the crimes attaching to the name? By the way, the crimes would be the vices I just rubbed off, atheism, cannibalism, incest, those sorts of things. Should a distinction be made because of age? Sometimes Roman lawyers made an allowance for age as a factor in determining punishment. Should those who deny Christ be punished? And what's critical here is the question of what is the actual basis for punishment. And Christianity was banned. After 64, it was illegal. This is very unusual for the Romans. There were only three religions the Romans ever banned. They banned the cult of Dionysius for a while. And that's because of the behavior that it led certain women into. It was what we would describe today as a deeply immoral cult. And many of the Romans who banned it were afraid of the moral impact of this cult upon Roman women. And it was not perpetually banned. Once a certain degree of decadence and immorality had spread into the upper echelons of the Roman Empire, the ban was basically let go. But there was a period of time when this was banned. Druidism was banned. So these are cults that are banned. The reason why Druidism was banned, Druidism was the religion of the Celts in France, what we call France, in parts of Britain. And Druidism, especially in Britain, was a part of the backbone of opposition to Roman occupation. And so there were military reasons for banning Druidism. And then the other religion that was banned is Christianity, the true religion. And so this is quite unusual in many respects for Roman culture. What is it about Christianity? Is it the crimes? Is it the name? The mere name of being accused as a Christian and maintaining, yes, I am a Christian, as we will see in this letter, is sufficient to secure condemnation. And there's a reason for this, as we will see. The reason lies in one particular word that we'll get to. So he's got a variety of questions then. It's also noteworthy that the charges are initiated not by Pliny. Pliny is presented with accusations. He is not the one conducting the investigation initially. He's presented with accusations. Notice he says, for instance, in section 5, an anonymous pamphlet was issued containing many names. And not surprisingly, some people probably thought, you know, when people were being executed, well, maybe this is a way of getting rid of so-and-so who I've always had a beef against, and I'll put his name forward. He's a Christian. And this goes right against Roman law. In Roman law, there had to be, and much of our legal system in some respects is built on Roman law and precedent. When an accusation was made, the accuser had to be present at the trial. And this didn't always prevail. In Nero's Rome, when Nero was running Rome, this was not the case.
But this is now 40, 50 years later, when Trajan, a very good emperor from the point of view of Rome, was ruling Rome. He upheld this whole idea, this key principle, that when an accusation was made against another, the accuser had to be present in the trial. That precedent might lie behind why Paul's first accusation, first period of imprisonment in 58 to 62, failed, because his accusers, who were Jews in Jerusalem, failed to show in Rome. I think that's a very reasonable understanding as to why Paul was probably released after house imprisonment. That's clearly what's going on here. Trajan actually will speak against the whole idea of anonymous pamphlets. There is also an informer. Notice number 6. An informer. Somebody who came and made concrete accusations. Notice Pliny. This is critical. Pliny did not initiate the accusations. There are charges being made to him. And then, if one asks the question, why? What lies at the basis of all this? Well, what's interesting is at the end, in section 10, we read there that the temples have been deserted, and so there will be a loss of prestige on the part of those involved in temple worship, a loss of power. There's also financial losses, because when you went to the temple to offer, to do obeisance to the Roman gods, you sacrificed an animal. You had to buy the animal. So local sellers of animals, their business has gone down the drain, so to speak. And it was in their economic interest to get people going back to the temples. This had larger ramifications than simply farmers selling animals. It also meant the restaurants in the area would suffer, because restaurants, public restaurants, normally were attached to the temples. And they actually derived their meat from the temple sacrifice. That's what Paul's talking about, by the way, in 1 Corinthians 10 and so on. 1 Corinthians 8 to 10. That whole idea of the sacrifice to the dedication of the meat to the gods, etc. So there's a number of things that this is a very revealing text. Pliny's difficulties with knowing exactly what to do indicate that even though he was a lawyer, he did not have legal precedent that he could easily draw on, which means that while persecution of the church was going on, it was not as widespread as some scholars have sometimes thought in these early, or very early decades. Secondly, it's very revealing in terms of the way in which prosecution was accomplished. Charges were made to Pliny. He didn't initiate them. That would change. Thirdly, there lies behind all of this mundane reasons for the persecution, namely economic reasons are certainly critical. Now, how did Pliny deal with those who persisted in their profession of Christ? What was typical in these sort of trials was a question would be asked: are you a Christian? Notice in section 3, I asked them if they are Christians. He would then repeat this twice. And a lot of we have about 40 to 50 accounts of martyrs, written, most of them firsthand, by fellow believers. This was standard practice, where normally the person being interrogated would be asked, are you a Christian? And before the man would say yes, there would also be a join to that question: you need to realize that if you persist in this, you will be punished to the full extent of the law. I have power execute you. Are you a Christian? In other words, there would be the question asked along with repeated threats. And I asked the Christians, if they admitted, I repeat the question second and third time, threatening capital punishment. And he does divide the groups into two. Those who are not citizens, he can deal with and execute on the spot if they persist in their confession of faith. Those who are citizens, notice section 4, have to be sent to Rome, because a Roman citizen had the right of trial by the emperor, either the emperor directly or an emperor's official directly. And we see the Apostle Paul exercising that right
Roman citizens also had various other privileges. For instance, up until the end of the second century, Roman citizens could never be executed if they were going to be executed, but in one way, and that is by beheading with a sword or an axe. You could never crucify or give to lions or torture in horrific ways Roman citizens. We see that very clearly in the book of Acts. Paul using his privileges as a Roman citizen to secure freedom from arbitrary punishment. And that continues all through the second century. It's not until roughly around 190 when things begin to radically change in the empire that it doesn't matter who you are. The Rome can then toss all kinds of things against you. Perpetua, for instance, undergoes some horrific torture. And she's a Roman citizen, comes from a Roman senatorial family. Now, what is the critical issue at stake here? The critical issue is this. In section 3, after sentence I've just read, I do not doubt that whatever kind of crime it may be to which they have confessed, their pertinacity and inflexible obstinacy should certainly be punished. Now, the word obstinacy there is this word, contumacia, or actually contumacia. We have a word in English, it's very rarely used, which comes from this. It's contumacy. And it means exactly what is described here, inflexible obstinacy. Now, contumacia is a second-order offense. A person would be arrested and charged with a crime, and if they refuse, if it's not a capital offense, if they refuse to give up their ways, then they would be charged with the second-degree offense, contumacia. When a Roman official, if this were a Roman court, and one of you were on trial, and I were the Roman official, and I told you, you need to desist from this course of action, your refusal to obey me as a Roman official was contumacia. That alone was punishable by death. Because what you're doing is you're flouting the authority of the emperor. And when a Roman official tells you, Christianity is wrong, you need to give up Christianity, and you refuse to do so, that alone is enough to secure your death. Regardless of whether or not these other issues could be proven, which they can't, atheism, incest, cannibalism, they could not be proven. But the issue then comes down to, are you going to give up your practice of Christianity at the word of a Roman official or not? In other words, then, it is enough to be a Christian to secure your condemnation. That was enough. And he really, in one sense, is answering his question right at the end of the first paragraph, whether the name itself, even if innocent crime, should be punished. The name itself is to be punished because a genuine Christian will not give his Christianity up. Now, those who were refused to give up their faith were executed. Citizens were sent to Rome. Notice that during the trial, a number of things were done. In addition to the question being repeated with the threat of capital punishment, he also brought out statues of the gods. Statues of the gods and a statue, an image of the emperor. He actually uses different words there. The word for the statues of the gods, because they called upon the gods, and together with the statues of the deities, that's in section 5. The statues of the deities are simulacra. What he uses of the emperor, though, is an imago. There is actually a difference. And as a Roman, he's making that difference. The simulacra are actual. The Roman thinking was that these statues actually are indwelt by the divinity. And we'll see this in the letter to Diognetus. There are some contemporary scholars who would argue that the Romans actually, none of the peoples in the ancient world actually believed that the statue was a god. They believed that these statues were portals or windows to the divine. But every evidence we have speaks otherwise. There was actually a ceremony when a statue of a god was made. There was actually a ceremony in which the divinity was invited to enter into the physical thing that had been made. Some sort of kind of consecration of the statue. The imago of the emperor is different. The imago of the emperor was like any image that the emperors would put up around the empire. Imago that was stamped on their coins. Imagos that were stamped in stone, either in a sculpted form or in a relief on another structure like an arch. They were designed for a number of reasons. One of them was to make the emperor present throughout the empire. Some of them were propaganda purposes. They themselves do not bespeak divinity. And so he uses, it's interesting, he uses a different word. And that's because as a Roman, he does not believe that the emperor himself is a god. It's the genius who indwells the emperor, of which this is a physical image. So it's a bit different. The truth of the matter is, the Romans, the Christians, saw a little difference between them. As far as they were concerned, rightly, it's all idolatry. Now, the big question that he's really wrestling with is, what to do with people who say they were Christians, but now deny it? That's the real question. Should they be punished because they once had the name? And, the other thing he does here, he has them curse Christ. That's a fascinating thing. Why would he lead them to do that? And it's no wonder the early church saw behind persecution other powers at work. They saw behind persecution the evil one. Notice, if you're in the text there, go back to the beginning of that section of material, the Martyrs of Lyon. It looks like the Acts of the Christian Martyrs. By the way, if you want to follow this up with, you can read all the accounts that we have are in that book, The Acts of the Christian Martyrs. There might be one or two it doesn't have, but basically it's got them all. And in the Martyrs of Lyon, in the first section there, this is what is page 63. The second paragraph, the intensity of our afflictions here, the deep hatred of the pagans for the saints, the magnitude of the blessed martyrs' sufferings, we are incapable of describing detail. Indeed, it would be impossible to put it down in writing. The adversary swooped down with full force, in this way anticipating his final coming, which is sure to come. They're thinking of the coming of the Antichrist, and so on. He went to all lengths to train and prepare his minions against God's servants. The result was we were not only shut out of our houses, the baths, the public square, but they forbade any of us to be seen in any place whatsoever. That text is describing... that text is describing, from the point of view of the early church, an element of the theology of martyrdom. Well, who lies behind the attack on the church? It's Satan. That's who lies behind the attack on the church. And I think you see that very clearly in this account by Pliny. Is why the cursing of Christ? And there is this demonic element that enters into the persecution of the church. It's not merely a political issue, but there is this spiritual element there. It's also noteworthy that some of those said who they had been Christians, some recanted it, he says, this is section 6, 3 years ago, some of them 20 years ago. So if you do the math, this is around the year 110. So 20 years before or more is around 90. And in other words, the gospel has been preached in this region back before 90, And in fact, if we have Peter's letters, it goes back an entire generation before that, because 1 Peter chapter 1 to the exiles who are in Pontus and Bithynia, among others. The other very important element of this text, the reason why this text is so significant for study in the early church, is not only the view of the Roman state towards Christianity. I'm going to say one or two other remarks there in a minute. But also what it tells us about early church worship. Because what Pliny does is he finds out, he wants to find out what are actually Christians doing. He finds out they are completely innocent of any crime. It's really not, they're not actually up to anything. But he persists in persecution because of that. Because of the refusal of Christians to obey the word of a Roman official, they deserve to be punished. Even if, as he knows from examination, they're not really guilty of anything. Now, the assembly of believers, he asks them, what do they do? Well, verse 7. They declared the sum of their guilt or error amounted only to this. On the appointed day, they had been accustomed to meet before daybreak. That is the Lord's day. And the worship of the church on the Lord's day is obviously rooted in the New Testament. But here is another witness to it. A specific day of the week is appointed for the celebration of worship. They would meet before daybreak frequently because that is the only time when slaves could get free. When the master of the house rises and the wealthy didn't always do this because they had the ability to stay up late. You might be thinking, what do I mean by that? Well, they had the ability to pay to stay up late because they could use oil in their lamps. Only the wealthy could really do that. On a long-term basis. Normally, a significant amount of wealth would be spent on oil, and so normally people's cycle was you went to bed when the sun went down, you got up when it got up. And definitely when the master got up at daybreak, he wanted whatever the slaves were going to do for him that day, and so slaves would not have been free. The Roman world did not make a difference regarding the various days of the week. And so you were to gather a worship, it would have to be before the day's duties began, which means that the early church is probably gathering in the wintertime, maybe 5, maybe 6 o'clock in the morning. In the summer, you're looking at maybe 3:30, 4 o'clock, that early. Secondly, what actually happened at such services? There was worship. Sung, worship, hymns of praise. We may have occasion in the week to look at a couple of these. Some of these are embedded in the New Testament. I do follow scholarly opinion that Philippians 2, 5 through 11 is probably a hymn that Paul has taken. Where have this mind in you which was in Christ Jesus, that though being in the form of God, he did not consider equality of God something to be grasped, and so on. That probably, and the Greek, if you look through the Greek reads like it's got a Greek poetic form. 3:16 has a poetic form like this. There are probably 3 or 4 kind of hymnic fragments in the New Testament. 1 Timothy 3:16, without controversy, great is the mystery of godliness. God is manifest in the flesh, justified in the spirit, seen of angels, preached unto the Gentiles, believed on in the world, received up into glory. Again, the actual meter is very poetic. Some scholars believe that Ephesians chapter 5 is an early Christian hymn. Ephesians 5 and verse 14, awake thou that sleepest, arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. Embedded as they are in the text, as we read them, they appear part of the prose, but there is, I think, some good evidence that they follow a meter and may well be hymnic. But there is singing of a hymn to Christ as to a God. It's interesting he notes that. He obviously doesn't believe in the deity of Christ, But right from the very beginning, there was worship of Christ. That marks the early church. And, you know, this is off to the side a little. Although picking this up, when you read certain contemporary scholars, liberals, who read the scriptures, you wonder if they're reading the same text as we are. When they talk about the early church in the New Testament didn't believe in the deity of the Lord Jesus Christ. I just don't know what text these men are reading. The truth of the matter is they're blind. And they need to be born again for the scriptures to make any sense to them. The early church worshipped Christ. Very clear, right from the beginning. And this is a pagan witness to that fact. There is also what he says there, they bind themselves by an oath. Scholars think that this is one of two things. Either it's prayer, or it could be the recitation of the Decalogue. Because notice what to abstain from theft, robbery, adultery, breach of faith. Remember, this is coming through a pagan perspective. What he's interpreting everything through his grid. His grid is, in the Greco-Roman world, there was singing to gods. There was prayers. There were oaths that were taken. And so he's trying to interpret through his grid. And so what is actually going on here that he's referring to? It's either prayer, the oath is a prayer, or it's the recitation of the Decalogue. The Decalogue would be widely used in these early centuries. Let me ask you, what is not mentioned? There's some element that is critical that is not mentioned. It's no preaching. It would be wrong, completely wrong, to think, oh, well, there was no preaching at these services. There was preaching, but he would not have understood it. He had no frame of reference in which to place that. Because in Greek and Roman worship, there was no preaching. You didn't gather as a group at a temple to offer sacrifices. You would go individually. There's no preaching. There are no holy books. The holiest of books in the Roman world, the Greek world, would be Homer's Iliad and Odyssey and Virgil's Aeneid. But they're hardly, nobody preached from those books. They were mythological books that lay at the foundation of who the Greeks were, who the Romans were. But there's no such thing in his mind to accommodate preaching. Which, by the way, again, is very interesting. Very interesting. For those who argue in our day for a seeker-sensitive kind of model of worship and say, claim, well, our culture no longer is characterized by people listening to a monologue, quote-unquote. Well, nor was the Greco-Roman world. And yet the early church did not in any way, shape, or form accommodate itself to that pagan world, but drew from its Jewish synagogue roots, where the exposition of the word was absolutely vital to synagogue worship, and it takes that into the early church's life. And it is a very clear illustration of there is no accommodation to the culture in that whole area. That is not mentioned because he doesn't have any understanding of that in his own religious background. If he had heard it, he wouldn't know what it was. And it doesn't mean it didn't take place. The other thing that is mentioned is an evening service. Notice there are two services. That's again interesting. One in the morning before daybreak, the other in the evening. In the evening, they gather, he says, to take food. That probably is the Lord's Supper. He may be referring to the agape, that was the feast that sometimes accompanied the Lord's Supper. You find reference to that in Jude 12, 1 Corinthians 11, 19 to 20. There are references to the agape. 1 Corinthians 11, 19 to 20. This is a meal that would be also usually preceding the Lord's table. I think the separation of the Lord's table from that meal is made in the New Testament. I think the Apostle Paul makes that. There are some today who would argue we need to go back and having a meal. I don't think that's part of the Lord's Supper. Normally, the main meal of the Roman day was in the evening, in the last hours of daylight. And so this is probably then a reference to that sort of experience.